Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA LP 106.1 FM Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, February 11th, 2006. Over the past couple of weeks, we've been hearing a lot from Bush. For example, his State of the Union address, his speech in Manchester this past week. However, in other arenas, people have been talking about him. Today we bring you excerpts from the International Commission of Inquiry on Crimes Against Humanity Committed by the Bush Administration. Their culminating sessions were held the weekend of January 20th, 2006, at Riverside Church and Columbia Law School. We'll also bring you audio interviews from the recent World Social Forum in Venezuela, an anti-war protest by Rutgers students, labor news, media minutes, music, and more. First, we bring you some news with Steve Diamond.
This is Steve Diamond with some news you may have missed. Democracy's special forces face heat, from the Christian Science Monitor. A new diplomatic row between the United States and Venezuela escalated recently when President Hugo Chavez expelled a U.S. naval attaché for espionage, prompting Washington to order the Venezuelan ambassador's chief of staff to leave the U.S. Mr. Chavez fanned the flames in front of thousands of supporters Saturday by vowing to buy more arms to defend his country from a possible U.S. invasion. Beyond the heated rhetoric on both sides, one of the actions the Chavez government views as most threatening is the U.S. government's funding and support of opposition groups that Chavez charges hopes to overthrow his government. Tuesday, the Attorney General is scheduled to take a get-out-the-vote group called Sumate to court on conspiracy charges for accepting over $31,000 from the U.S.-funded National Endowment for Democracy. The case, which comes at a time when U.S.-sponsored democracy-building programs are facing increased scrutiny worldwide, has bolstered Chavez's claims that the U.S. is meddling in Venezuelan affairs. Sumate's National Endowment for Democracy money is small change compared with the millions of dollars given to Venezuelan groups by a little-known branch of the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, called the Office for Transition Initiatives. The Venezuelan government and some analysts question OTI's motives in Venezuela, since it is less transparent than the other USAID agencies, more directly tied to U.S. foreign policy interests, and has unusual budgetary flexibility. U.S. aid agencies have been under scrutiny in Venezuela since it was revealed that some members of U.S.-funded groups were at the forefront of the opposition movement and supported the failed coup against Chavez in 2002. But OTI's mode of operations, until recently, has gone under the radar. Called, quote, the Special Forces of Development Assistance by Harvard University public policy professor Robert Rotberg, OTI was designed in the 1990s to help former Soviet Union countries make the transition to democracy. It now works in areas such as Iraq, Haiti, Sudan, and the West Bank. Even though Venezuela is not experiencing the kind of civil strife seen in countries where OTI operates, OTI devoted $4.5 million to its Venezuelan program in 2005, more than six times NED's budget. OTI, which derives its money from disaster assistance funding, can issue urgent short-term grants much faster than normal USAID programs. OTI says it works to nurture Venezuela's, quote, fragile democratic institutions by funding groups that strengthen human rights, the judicial system, and public dialogue in a polarized society. But critics have raised concerns. Riordan Roet, director of Latin American Studies at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, said, the Bush administration's nation-building mission includes trying to weaken or challenge the Chavez administration. OTI is really at the front line of what the administration thinks of Venezuela. The State Department accuses Chavez of bordering on dictatorship, saying he is gaining near-total control over the judicial system, the legislature, and the nation's vital oil industry. The Venezuelan government responds that Chavez's party and its allies have won all seven elections held in the past 7 years. It questions why the U.S. is using an agency dedicated to transition initiatives when Venezuela has been a democracy since 1958. It's absolutely outrageous, says lawyer Eva Golinger, who investigates U.S. funding in Venezuela. This isn't a government in transition at all. For an entity that is allegedly promoting democracy and using U.S. taxpayer dollars to do so, OTI is highly secretive, and suspiciously so. OTI has broken an initial promise made by one of its implementing partners to stay in Venezuela only 2 years. The agency is designed to stay in a country for no more than 2 or 3 years, but has been in Venezuela for almost 4 years. The U.S. government says OTI is still operating there, housed in the U.S. Embassy, because Congress has not earmarked enough funds for USAID to open its own office in the country. Rowett says Washington opted against a larger USAID mission because it might be seen as a provocation to Chavez. Yet, unlike most USAID programs, OTI describes itself as, quote, overtly political, and particularly tied to foreign policy goals. In order to issue grants quickly, OTI can spend money free from earmarks from specific programs that Congress often puts on regular USAID funds. OTI says on its website that transparency is one of its, quote, strategic principles, but declined to release the names of its grantees and denied requests for any on-the-record interviews on its Venezuela program. The U.S. government did agree by phone to release to the Monitor descriptions of all 2005 OTI grants, with most of the grantees' names blacked out. These documents have not yet been received. This is being done devoid of public scrutiny, said Larry Burns of the Council of Hemispheric Affairs in Washington. I personally think that it's outrageous that the U.S. government can dispose funds with no real consultation. And next, a report says that Cheney told Libby of CIA identity, from United Press International. A legal opinion in the Valerie Plame Leak case includes new information about how I. Lewis Libby learned she was a CIA officer. Libby, the only person charged so far, told prosecutors he learned about her from his boss, Vice President Dick Cheney, the New York Times reported. Nevertheless, Libby maintains that he was learning about Wilson's wife's identity for the first time when he spoke with NBC Washington Bureau Chief Tim Russert on July 10th or 11th, Judge David Tattle of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia said. Parts of Tattle's opinion were not released until Friday. The Wall Street Journal sued for their disclosure after Libby was indicted. Some parts of the opinion that apparently involved the investigation into Karl Rove's part in the affair remain sealed, the Times said. Libby has been charged with perjury, not with leaking Plame's identity. She is married to former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, a critic of President Bush's Iraq policy. And from the Scotsman, use of force against Iran is on the agenda, warns bullish Rumsfeld. American military action against Iran because of its nuclear ambitions is still an option, U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has warned. With Iran remaining defiant in the face of international pressure over its atomic program, it recently ended snap UN inspections of its atomic sites, Mr. Rumsfeld upped the stakes, describing Iran as a, quote, main sponsor of terrorist groups. A senior Iran defense official added to the tough talk yesterday with a senior military commander saying its forces would teach any attackers, quote, a lesson that will be remembered throughout history. And Iranian MPs agreed yesterday to urgently debate a parliamentary bill that would put restrictions on the sale of, quote, unnecessary American goods sold in the country in response to the U.S. stance on its nuclear ambitions. Iran was reported to the UN Security Council on Saturday after failing to allay suspicions that it is seeking nuclear weapons. Mr. Rumsfeld, who attended a weekend security conference in Munich, Germany, made no bones about the seriousness of the situation. All options, including the military one, are on the table, he told a German newspaper. Any government that says Israel has no right to exist is making a statement about its possible behavior in the future. At the conference, Mr. Rumsfeld accused Tehran of being behind international terrorism. Iran is the main sponsor of terrorist organizations such as Hezbollah and Hamas, he said. His belligerent tone was echoed by Abdul Rahim Mousavi, the Iranian head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who told Iranian troops yesterday, "We are not seeking a military confrontation, but if that happens, we will give the enemy a lesson that will be remembered throughout history. This nation has proved its will many times to its enemies. Why do they want to test this great nation once again?" Iran is armed with an unknown number of Shahab-3 ballistic missiles that could reach Israel and U.S. bases in the Gulf, and if combined with nuclear warheads sometime in the future, would give it the ability to fulfill President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's desire to, quote, wipe Israel off the map. Mr. Ahmadinejad said nothing could deflect Tehran's pursuit of atomic know-how. He said, "Our enemies cannot do a damn thing. We do not need you at all. But you are in need of the Iranian nation," he told the crowd in Tehran yesterday. "Content yourself with as many resolutions as you like. You cannot prevent the will of the Iranian people." Iran has warned that any sanctions against it would send oil prices beyond the level industrialized countries could bear. However, there was a glimpse of a compromise yesterday. Last Saturday, Iran had declared dead a proposal by Moscow that Russia could enrich Iranian uranium for use in power stations. But yesterday, Foreign Ministry spokesman Hamid Reza Assefi said Iranian officials would meet with Russian counterparts to discuss the idea. And our last story, U.S. Senator McCain calls for leaders to boycott G8 summit in Russia. Information Save France Press. U.S. Senator John McCain called upon world leaders to boycott the G8 summit in Russia in July, questioning Moscow's commitment to democracy. In a speech to the Munich Conference on Security Policy, McCain said that President Vladimir Putin had rolled back reforms in Russia and did not share the democratic values of the United States and Europe. McCain said, "Under Mr. Putin, Russia today is neither a democracy nor one of the world's leading economies, and I seriously question whether the G8 leaders should attend the St. Petersburg summit." The high-profile Republican senator for Arizona, a former prisoner of war in Vietnam who unsuccessfully ran for the U.S. presidency in 2000, said Russia could have helped the United States and Europe transform the world following the end of the Cold War. He said, "The Kremlin, however, shows no interest in such a relationship. Instead, it continues to pursue foreign and domestic policies strongly at odds with our interests and values. Even after Iran rejected the EU-3 talks and removed nuclear seals, Moscow indicated that it would proceed with a $1 billion deal to sell short-range missiles to Iran." With Russia's powerful defense minister, Sergei Ivanov, looking on, McCain said Russia had punished, quote, "democratic" Ukraine and Georgia by disrupting energy supplies, quote, "while providing cut-rate gas to the dictatorship in Minsk." Russia continues to prosecute a brutal war in Chechnya that has killed as many as 200,000, radicalizing the Muslim population, and it actively supports dictatorships in Central Asia. McCain added, "The broadcast media are Kremlin-controlled, as are the parliament, provincial governors, and the judiciary. All of these were free and independent when Mr. Putin took office." McCain described Iran as, quote, "the world's chief state sponsor of international terrorism," and said it defines itself by hostility to the United States and Israel. Tehran's continued pursuit of nuclear weapons plainly poses an unacceptable risk to the international community, he said.
And now for Media Minutes, a weekly review of news at the intersection of media and democracy.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson. On February 7th, the contentious concept of network neutrality made its public debate debut on Capitol Hill. For more than 2 hours, members of the Senate's Commerce Committee listened to testimony from academics and online content and application providers about the need to make sure telephone and cable companies don't try to discriminate between types of data bits transported over their networks based on an online speaker's ability to pay. Senators first wrestled with just what the concept of network neutrality actually is. Jeffrey Citron, CEO of the voice-over IP telephone service provider Vonage, offered a helpful analogy to illustrate how abandoning the concept would fundamentally change the nature of information control on the Internet.
Imagine if the electric company could dictate which toaster or television you plug into the wall. Plug in our pre-approved affiliated toaster, and your power will work great, but if you don't, we can't promise the same level of service. Of course, this sounds ridiculous. Power companies don't care who makes our toasters or our televisions. We plug them in, and they just simply work. The same should be true for the Internet.
Doing away with network neutrality will also diminish the robustness of the Internet itself. Gary Bakula spoke at the hearing as a representative of a consortium of universities and corporations that are developing what's called Internet 2, the next generation of broadband connectivity, which offers speeds at least 100 times faster than current broadband connections. Bakula told senators that data discrimination does nothing but complicate network design and increase the cost of network construction.
All of our research and practical experience supported the conclusion that it was far more cost-effective to simply provide more bandwidth. With enough bandwidth, there is no congestion.
Therefore, so long as adequate broadband capacity exists, there is no need to abandon the principle of network neutrality. However, instead of providing that capacity, phone and cable companies would rather skimp on the growth and maintenance of their network infrastructures in order to squeeze every penny possible out of all network users. In other words, the corporate drive to abandon network neutrality stems primarily from claims that broadband bandwidth is in scarce supply. Vinton Cerf argued that such a rationale is disingenuous. He should know. Commonly called a father of the Internet, now a vice president at Google, Cerf co-developed the core protocols that make Internet-based communication possible. And he says until there is true nationwide availability of broadband, something major phone companies in particular pledged to do several years ago, any claim that a viable bandwidth marketplace exists in the U.S. rings hollow.
According to the statistics from the FCC in 2004, only 53% of Americans had a choice of broadband access, either from cable companies or from the telcos with their DSL service. 28% have only one choice, either cable or DSL, and 19% don't have any choice at all. There is no broadband.
Those who represented the big phone and cable companies at the hearing seemed to be on the defensive from the public backlash that has developed over the last month over this issue. Kyle McCormick, president of the United States Telecom Association, a trade group that lobbies in D.C. for the likes of AT&T, Bell South, and Verizon, among many others, made what appeared to be a solemn and significant pledge.
Our commitment to you is this. We will not block, impair, or degrade content, applications, or services.
But McCormick argued strongly against formalizing the principle of network neutrality in law out of a supposed fear that such government regulation would stifle further innovation on the Internet. Stanford Law professor Lawrence Lessig strongly disagreed. He noted that although the words network neutrality might not be written down anywhere in U.S. telecommunications law, it is the key principle that has governed the construction and regulation of communications networks in the United States for at least the last four decades.
I feel a little bit like the stable boy who spends his whole life shoveling, I guess I can't use that word here, right? And I'm surrounded by a bunch of academics offering a bunch of theories about how we should remake telecommunications law to get to the grand new age. And I say, you should look to the past and learn the lessons from the past before you radically change the infrastructure within which innovation has occurred.
For now, the future of the Internet remains murky. At least one senator has pledged to introduce legislation that would mandate network neutrality among Internet service providers, but there's no indication of just how much support exists for such an effort. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
You're listening to Making Waves. We now bring you a report from WBAI on a counter-recruitment demonstration put on by Rutgers students.
Troops out now! Iraq for Iraqis! Troops out now! Iraq for Iraqis! Troops out now! Iraq for Iraqis!
An insight into why the Bush administration has not yet instituted a military draft was given by Rutgers University teacher James Livingston, a member of Historians Against the War.
If you look at the history of the Vietnam debacle, and if you look at what's happening during this truly insane adventure in Iraq, you'll see that the military is at the heart of the rebellion against the doctrine, against the policies. It wasn't us nice middle-class student college professor types who ended the war. It was the military in Vietnam who ended the war. That's why a volunteer army was the result of that disaster.
Professor Livingston further states that while the U.S. military has always served the state, its leadership now is at odds with the Bush administration's strategy.
Generals Lute, Casey, and Abizade had been absolutely consistent in undermining every argument that Rumsfeld and Bush have made to the Congress and to the people. They said, no, we don't have the numbers. No, these are not foreign fighters. No, the insurgency is not weakening. The best way to legitimize the possibility of democracy in Iraq, they say, is to end the occupation. Whatever electoral results we might see are tainted by the occupation.
The increase in the military effort has resulted in drastic cuts in domestic spending. Vicky White from the Central Jersey People Organization for Progress believes that the Katrina disaster aftermath has a lot to do with military spending.
Hundreds of billions of dollars have been spent in Iraq while Gulf Coast families are left jobless and homeless. Come Tuesday, February 7th, these families will be left out in the cold. Economically, the war hurts all of us. We need to continue to be in the streets, in the neighborhoods, yes, talking to people, getting the word out. Woo! We don't see any of those tax cuts, which Bush has asked to be made permanent. The rich are getting rich off our back.
Counter-recruitment actions on university campus has resulted in repressive measures, and as recently revealed, under pretext of national security, systematic spying on peace groups has occurred. Michael DeMola from the New York Campus Anti-War Network shared his protest experience at City College.
And on March 2005, second anniversary of the war, 20 students protested at a career fair. Three students were harassed by the campus security, and one administrative faculty was arrested as well. All charged with assault, all are false claims. The spying on the students and the repression at campus is a symbol of dissent that they don't want to hear, because it speaks to the truth. It speaks to their agenda, and it speaks to something so immoral that you can no longer turn a blind eye to it.
The three students won in court and have since been reinstated. After the rally, the crowd marched on the recruitment center a block away for a short but animated vigil.
If you love the land of the free, bring them home, bring them home.
That's not it.
Put them over sea,
bring them home,
bring them home.
We don't want to fight for oil,
bring them home, bring them home.
Underneath some foreign soil,
bring them home,
bring them home.
We need levees, we need schools,
bring them home,
bring them home.
For the WBI Sunday News, this is Fred Gwynn in New Brunswick, New Jersey.
January 24th through 29th, 2006, the latest World Social Forum was held in Caracas, Venezuela. The World Social Forum is a time for activists and people working for change all over the world to come together to share information, tactics, stories, and to network. Between the Lines producers, Scott Harris and Anna Manzo, were there, and they filed these interviews.
We're speaking with Medea Benjamin. Medea, just tell us a little bit about what you think the significance of this sixth social forum here in Venezuela is.
Well, the significance is we're here at a time where Latin America is just on fire in terms of revolutionary fervor, in terms of showing that another world is indeed possible because they're doing it here. And we are coming from the United States at a terrible time in our history. So it's really a time for us to learn, a time for us to seek answers, a time for us to seek solidarity. And I think a lot of us from the U.S. will go back very inspired.
And what are you personally going to try and take back from this conference to the people you meet in the United States? I know you also have a delegation here from Global Exchange.
Well, we have a very small goal, which is to build a really global peace movement. So we're going to use this time really well to go around and make strong networks with each other and really be able to have joint campaigns.
Okay. We'll see you later, hopefully, in the day.
That was Medea Benjamin with Global Exchange and Code Pink. Now, they speak with Sherry Hankala from the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about what brought you here and the connections between your struggles back in the States for poor people and economic rights and what is unfolding here in Latin America, and especially at the World Social Forum.
For us, this is huge. I've been trying for like over 10 years to have the international community understand that we have very serious problems, and it's of strategic significance to highlight those problems in the media around the world. And people would generally shrug their shoulders and say, I'm sure it's kind of rough. But sorry to say, after the hurricane Katrina, people, I think, got a short little window on the reality that our government really doesn't care about the people of our country, regardless of what color, what age they were, what part of town they lived in. The American people were just basically abandoned. And the fact that they continue to spend trillions of dollars on the war and not rebuild homes for the victims of Katrina, not to even mention the massive amounts of people that are on waiting lists because there's no rooms and shelters across our entire country, shows the absolute devastating situation that we have. The more money that is spent every single day on this war and other wars comes directly out of the mouths of babies and healthcare programs and schools and housing for the people in our country. You know, we're tired of burying people that are dying of AIDS and are homeless. From the 700,000 people that are about to die in Tennessee that have been cut off of Medicaid, that have been engaged in a sit-in in the Capitol, to disabled veterans that can't get health care. You know, I could just go on forever. But this is the very first time in the last 10 years that I've been at and all the different international things that they saw it of strategic significance for the world to have the largest tent here be the U.S. tent to show solidarity and to hear firsthand from the people in my country about who they are and their day-to-day realities. So I think that this is a major thing. I think that it's going to be very difficult for our administration to hide things anymore, because the 10 days that we're here, our plea to the international media is to please, you know, open the doors, show the windows, show the reality of what's happening in our country. Then I think we're going to get the kind of solidarity and the help that we need from other social movements around the world.
There's a progressive movement, of course, sweeping Latin America for some years now. It seems to be, you know, getting even stronger. What kinds of lessons do you think we can learn in the United States from the progressive activists who have had so much success here in Latin America?
You know, I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned from what's taking place in Latin America, and you can't just have political education for folks. You got to figure out how to, like, feed, clothe, and house people as you develop leaders. And the U.S. has been really good with a lot of rhetoric, and organizers have missed the boat on helping to provide the basic necessities of life. And that's what's important about our movement. We come from the ranks of the poor. We know what it is to, like, almost freeze to death with our kids. And so we know things like having a place to sleep at night is crucial if we're going to develop leaders in a social movement to deal with our oppressive government.
And lastly, what kinds of issues do you want people here in Latin America and all over the world who come to the social forum, what's the number one thing that you want them to bring home with them about the reality of the United States?
That poverty does indeed exist. It's very real. And somebody dying because they're homeless in the U.S. is no different than somebody dying because they're homeless in Brazil or Africa. Somebody dying because they don't have health care is wrong, particularly in our country. The one thing that all these human rights violations have in common in our country is they could all be prevented. There's something far more criminal about that. So we're asking for visibility. We're asking for resources. Both, you know, medical supplies, you know, students, interns from different parts of the world. I mean, you name it, we need help with it. It's a big country. The problems are incredible. We're up against a great deal of opposition. And the amount of money that goes into Homeland Security, which is really about suppressing the civil liberties of people in our country, unless the world participates in helping us build this movement, we're not going to succeed. So those are really the two messages that we have this week, we exist and we need help. Thank you.
Thank you, Sherry.
That was Between the Lines producer Scott Harris speaking at the World Social Forum in Caracas, Venezuela, with Sherry Hongkala of the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign. Next is an interview with an Iraq war veteran.
My name is Jeffrey Millard, and I was in the U.S. Army National Guard, New York State, activated to full active duty for Operation Iraqi Freedom.
And why are you here in Venezuela, here at the World Social Forum? What brought you here?
Well, actually, the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign brought me down, and I'm here to let people know that the billions of dollars that are continuously spent on this war could be going to poor people in America. And poor people in America are suffering because these billions of dollars are going overseas and into Iraq and not into the communities where they need to go. They're not going into the American communities. They're not going to feed hungry American children. They're not going to rebuild the homes after Katrina and Rita. Instead, they're going to destroy another country and take more human life in Iraq.
And what's your personal opinion of the war in Iraq, having fought there yourself?
Well, I've got several opinions. One is that it should never have been fought. It was fought for money and not just for oil. Oil is an oversimplification of the end result. What we really have is the military-industrial complex and a continuation of the funding going into the military-industrial complex. That's what it's about. It's about continuing warfare so that you can continue the military machine. And by continuing the military machine and keeping the American people afraid, then they're not out in the streets demanding that they all have health care, demanding that their children have a decent school to go to. And so therefore, because they're kept afraid by this so-called terrorism that's out there, then it's a continuous effect on the American people. And that's what the war in Iraq is about. And that's why I'm here, is to let the world know that that is the case.
What role do you think the media plays in the United States in perpetuating some of these policies of the Bush administration, which at the moment aren't all that popular, but certainly popular enough to get the guy reelected at least once? Not the first time possibly, but not this last time.
Well, one of the interesting things about that is the fact of the matter is that the media, while it has flak machines built into it, never questions the morality, the positive morality of the Bush administration's policies. And therefore, you get a continuing effect, even if it appears as though they're criticizing the policies themselves, while they never question the underlying morality and rightness of the policy. Therefore, they never truly question the policy.
That's true. And just speaking about Iraq again, you know, I think American people and probably people around the world have this view that, you know, the military is 100% behind the Bush policy in Iraq. Obviously, that couldn't be true. But what's your experience in serving there and speaking with your fellow soldiers?
Well, Iraq Vets Against War, being over our just about 200 members strong right now and being across the country and building daily, is proof that the military isn't 100% behind the Bush administration. And while a lot of people that even aren't won't join our organization because we do demand troops home now, that doesn't lessen the effects of those troops that are still there that disagree with the military, disagree with the purpose that we have here in the Bush administration. So there is a contingent of American soldiers who are against the war. The American media likes to portray American soldiers as completely for the war, completely for the Bush administration. But in reality, the military is a cross-section of the entire United States population. And if the entire United States population isn't for the war, how could logically the military be? And obviously, since there are groups like IVAW and Vets for Peace and various other groups, the military does not stand in solidarity with the Bush administration. We stand in solidarity with the American people who right now are getting the short end of the Bush administration stick.
Thanks to Between the Lines producers Scott Harris and Anna Manzo for those interviews from the World Social Forum in Caracas, Venezuela, January 24th through 29th, 2006. You're listening to Making Waves. Now for a song by Jeff Brown, Change the World.
So much confusion going on right here. What's the delusion? Are we living in fear? How many more lives need to be lost before we realize what it is costing us? Do we really practice what we preach? Change in this world, more people are dying than ever before. And even though we are scared, we gotta wake up from this nightmare and do what we need to do to change this world. Terrorists are shooting and bombing around, buildings are crumbling.
dying than ever before. And even though we are scared, we gotta wake up from this nightmare and do what we need to do to change this world. How many times do we have to relive this catastrophe? And how
That was Jeff Brown with Change the World. And now for some labor news, focusing today on minimum wage hikes driven by states.
This is labor news. Information about most of us. You can find us on the internet at labornews.us to listen to archived editions of our program. We receive emails at labornews.podcast@gmail.com. Write to us with comments and ideas. States lead way on minimum wage hikes. Nearly one half of Americans now live in states that require wages higher than the $5.15 an hour set by Congress 9 years ago. And the trend of states raising their minimum wage in the face of federal inaction shows no sign of fading. Just since the start of the year, one state has increased its minimum wage, a governor from each party has announced a wage hike is on his agenda, and supporters are rallying in 6 states where campaigns are underway for wage hike initiatives on the November ballot. Experts say the growing patchwork of laws setting various wage floors across the country is driven largely by the longest period without a congressionally mandated increase since the federal minimum wage was introduced in 1938. I think it will continue to be a hot issue for the states in 2006, said Janine Major, who tracks minimum wage issues for the National Conference of State Legislatures. Major predicts as many as 30 states could consider legislative proposals to increase the minimum wage this year, including 11 states where such proposals will carry over from 2005. Supporters of minimum wage increases claim they are needed to help lift people out of poverty and to strengthen workers' bargaining clout, while opponents argue that the minimum wage is too blunt an instrument to effectively combat poverty. Opponents also have argued that requiring companies to pay higher wages result in lower overall employment rates. But advocates for the poor still argue minimum wage increases as one of many strategies to combat poverty and to raise the living standards of low-income people. They also contest the notion that raising the minimum wage leads to layoffs. These are workers who have the weakest bargaining leverage and are most likely to be exploited, particularly in a period where you have a weak labor demand and a large labor supply, said Jared Bernstein, senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute, a think tank that supports minimum wage increases. Bernstein said he particularly supports efforts to tie minimum wage increases to inflation. Otherwise, wages for the lowest earners actually decrease in real terms every year there is no increase, he said. This was Labor News. Information about most of us.
Many of you probably did not know, and certainly in his recent speeches Bush never mentioned, that there has been an international commission of inquiry on crimes against humanity committed by the Bush administration, which recently held its last sessions. Those culminating sessions were held the weekend of January 20, 2006, at Riverside Church and Columbia Law School. The commission looked particularly at four aspects: wars of aggression, torture and indefinite detention, destruction of the global environment, attacks on global public health and reproductive rights. Today, we bring you a small sample from the commission. There are many hours of testimony, which you can find at www.bushcommission.org. We start with an intro to this particular session.
My name is Jeremy Pixer, and on behalf of the Not in Our Name Statement Organizing Committee, I'd like to welcome you to the opening session of the Commission on Crimes Against Humanity committed by the Bush administration. In the dark days after 9/11, when it seemed like all of the United States was in a frenzy of bloodlust for permanent war and world domination, several hundred Americans, prominent and respected in their fields, stepped forward and courageously said, "Not in our name." The Not in Our Name Statement of Conscience was a beacon of sanity and justice, giving hope and courage to tens of thousands of Americans who eventually signed the statement, helping to spark the anti-war movement and set the terms of debate. The statement read in part, "We believe that people of conscience must take responsibility for what their own governments do. We must first of all oppose the injustice that is done in our own name." When, despite massive national and international opposition, the Bush regime secured a second 4 years of rule, many found themselves again demoralized and paralyzed with fear and defeat. A second statement of conscience was written, extending the vision of the original to face the new challenge. It said, "No election, whether fair or fraudulent, can legitimize criminal wars on foreign countries, torture, the wholesale violation of human rights, and the end of science and reason." It is in the spirit of those statements that the Organizing Committee of the Not in Our Name Statements of Conscience organized this commission. I'm happy to introduce to you now a man who, more than perhaps any other single individual, is responsible for the creation and dissemination of these statements, as well as this commission, the convener of the Commission of Inquiry on Crimes Against Humanity committed by the Bush administration, Clark Kissinger.
Eight months ago, when we started this commission, who could have anticipated what has unfolded since then? The lying, the spying, the outrageous claims of the right to invade any country and seize, imprison, torture, and assassinate anyone that the president designates, unrestrained by any sense of law or morality. But the public is now beginning to come alive, with talk of impeachment in the air. And hey, look at that, for example, at that beautiful full-page ad in this morning's New York Times demanding that Bush step down. More and more people are beginning to see this regime as criminal. And the need to document and pass a moral judgment on these great crimes stands out even more sharply today. This is the responsibility of people in this country to the people of the world. We began the work of this commission on a very firm basis. We said, when the possibility of far-reaching war crimes and crimes against humanity exists, people of conscience have a solemn responsibility to inquire into the nature and scope of these acts and to determine if they do in fact rise to the level of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Since then, we have come to understand more deeply what constitutes a crime against humanity. Systematic brutal acts against whole populations that shock the conscience of humankind. And we have learned that there is more than one way to exhibit callous disregard for human life and put millions at risk, including the callous denial of science and reality itself that endangers whole populations. As we put these proceedings together, the aggregate impact of the scope and the severity of these crimes has shocked even the organizers and experts. People in different fields began to share their information, and we were stunned. What you will hear over the next 3 days will stun you as well. I urge you to attend all 3 days, as some of the most shocking testimony will come from ordinary people, victims of these policies that we are here to pass judgment upon. This commission's legitimacy is derived from its integrity, its rigor in the presentation of evidence, and the stature of its participants. And you should also know that representatives of the Bush administration were invited to come and present a defense. This commission's work is going to break new ground and impact the whole political terrain with its rigorous presentation of damning evidence. And in doing this, it speaks the unspeakable in daring to raise the cardinal question that is always suppressed, namely, is the administration of George W. Bush guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity? The commission will answer that question. And in doing so, it will deliver a verdict that will enlighten, empower, and embolden millions to stop these crimes. In doing that, this commission becomes an instrumentality of all humanity. The responsibility then falls on all of us here, having heard and seen the evidence, to take this out into society, fueling and reframing the debate from one about dishonesty and misconduct and bad intelligence and lawbreaking to one of unconscionable crimes against humanity. Thank you.
We continue listening to the International Commission of Inquiry on Crimes Against Humanity Committed by the Bush Administration, with their culminating sessions held the weekend of January 20th. We now hear Marcus Raskin, who is a keynote speaker at the event.
I want to introduce now our keynote speaker for the evening, Marcus Raskin. Marcus Raskin began his career as a special member of the special staff of the National Security Council in President Kennedy's administration. Many people of his generation came to different conclusions about what would make a decent world. And he moved very quickly from that to, in 1967, being one of the authors of the Call to Resist Illegitimate Authority. Some of you may remember that after the publication of that call, five people, Dr. Benjamin Spock, Marcus Raskin, Mitchell Goodman, Michael Ferber, and the Reverend William Sloan Coffin, were indicted by the federal government for conspiracy to obstruct the draft. Marcus went on to be a founding member of the Institute for Policy Studies. And he runs a very interesting website called Presidential Disrespect. I give you Marcus Raskin.
I very much appreciate being able to be here with you. And my own views may be somewhat at odds with what some of you may think, but bear with me anyway under the theory of freedom of speech. The issue of conscience is a very complicated one because it says, I know better than the rest of you. I know better than legitimate authority. I know better than others what's supposed to be. And in that sense, what is astonishing about the development of American history, really with the Vietnam War and with other events, is it's not a question of conscience to be against what's going on. It's a question of citizenship. It's a question of saying, what is it that a government is supposed to live with and be? What is it that a leadership is supposed to live with and be? And there are rules, and there are laws, which supposedly are to govern how people who are in power are supposed to act. That's the meaning of, for example, having a constitution, which itself may be seen as a somewhat constricting document. That's the meaning of saying that Nuremberg will put people on trial who are leaders who clearly go against laws, international laws, laws such as crimes against peace, the Kellogg-Briand Pact, laws which were already on the books regarding crimes against humanity, all of which then built up into this foundation of what governments are supposed to do. And so when we say conscience, we're here in the United States making a statement about what it means to be a citizen, where you're supposed to act, why you should be in the public space, why it should be clear that you're able to hold a government which calls about making war, aggressive war, on its own election, without Congress, without anybody, with no rules, in which then the citizens say, you can't do this. There is nothing which allows you, President Bush, to do this. And the reason that this is so important is not only for President Bush, it's for the next president. If you let this guy get away with it, if, for example, he is not impeached, if, for example, citizens don't speak out very clearly on what the rules and the laws are of behavior for leaders, we and our future generations are absolutely lost. There is just no question in my mind about that. Also, what will happen is that the laws indeed then will change, and the laws will become illegal. They will become criminal laws, clearly criminal laws, at which point, indeed, people of conscience will have to speak out. But right now, it's a citizenly activity, it's a citizenly responsibility to say, you're not getting away with this. None of you people is getting away with this. You have a situation here, in my view, where war was undertaken, aggressive war was undertaken, knowing there were no weapons of mass destruction. Nobody was going to look for them. There weren't any. The UN made that clear. You would not have generals going out to fight wars where the other side had weapons of mass destruction. You wouldn't do that. And the proof of it is in the case of Korea. So the whole issue has been one of deception from the beginning. It's a deception which allows us, which makes demands on us, to say our citizen responsibility is to say no. You can't get away with this. You can't get away with telling us lies. You can't get away with telling Congress lies. You can't put people in a position of being deceived. You can't put people in the position of sending their children to fight in wars that everyone in the government knows is fraudulent in terms of what they're attempting to do. Fraudulent. And that, therefore, again, goes back to this question of what it means to be a citizen. Now, there are also part of the things that are very important in this. A person acting in a geopolitical way in the government says, we can say and give any argument to do what we want. There's a lifestyle in America. People won't give up that lifestyle. We need the oil. We need to be on top. And in order to do that, we have to continue an imperial presence throughout the world. That's their argument with regard to environment. Don't tell us about the environment. We have to run the action because the American people expect us to do it. So that's another piece of this responsibility that has to be looked at by all of us. What is the kind of lifestyle we in fact want to accept and have, which will indeed keep people in the government on the run, living within the framework of what a humane and decent way is to live. So I want to just add a couple other things to this commentary. There are a number of you who, of course, were involved in the anti-Vietnam War struggle. That struggle also came out of illegitimate authority, in my mind. That, again, was not a question of conscience. It was a question of what it meant to be a citizen in this country. And the next step is, what does it mean to be a citizen in the world then and certainly now? In that sense, we are faced with the following problems. The United States has been involved in permanent war over the course of the last 60 years. And the fact of the matter is that one cannot forget that the United States, as a state, is a warrior nation state. From its inception, we indeed expanded that way. We were able to conquer the Indians that way. We were able to gain much from the First World War, from the Second World War, etc. So we have a problem of analysis ourselves of who we are and what we intend to be for the future. That again is a question of citizenly responsibility. When I say citizenly in this context, it is a social responsibility. It is predicated on people getting together to begin to talk about the first principles of what a social contract in the society should be for this next 50-year period. That issue of permanent war is crucial now because it's a pathology. Tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people live off of, for example, the idea of having military bases in their communities. Poor people live off of the possibility that there should be environmental dreck in their neighborhoods because it's better that way to be able to support themselves. Indian tribes are pushed into a situation of either taking on uranium trash or having gambling. And so each of these turns out to be the basis for all of us to say, what is this social compact we now want to have with each other? What is the basis of it? If it comes out of conscience, it means that there is a universal sentiment of what is right and what is wrong, which I think is probably true. But it is also the case that over the last 60 years, since the end of the Second World War and even before, this sentiment was there, this attempt to say, look, there are certain things that leaders can and can't do. There are certain things that states can and can't do. They cannot make war on their own. It was made very, very clear at Nuremberg. It was made very clear through the Kellogg-Briand Pact. It was put into concrete by the United States through the UN Charter, etc. Every step of the way, we see that there are legal and social foundations for acting in another way. And so when we talk about conscience, We are also talking about citizen responsibility. And citizen responsibility means social responsibility to each other and to be heard and to act. And I appreciate being here and thank you.
To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information, 430-9722.